Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Greetings, citizens of Earth and all beings, both extraterrestrial and interdimensional. My name is Danny Roth, and this is Who Won the Week, Sci-Fi Wire's podcast dedicated to the top stories from the week in geek. I am joined this week by my co-hosts and friends, the Blurred Girl, Kara Mahorn, and Sci-Fi Wire's own editor-in-chief, Adam Swiderski, a.k.a. Blockwoman.
Whoa.
I beat you to the joke.
Why would you do that?
That was so uncool. I stole your joke.
That was horrible.
Gotcha.
Gosh.
I'm sorry.
It's the holidays,
funny.
And you took from me instead of giving a gift.
That's right.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Scrooge.
I bought a bunch of wacky packages to give people, and then I forget. After the holidays, I'll give you your pack of wacky packages.
I don't know if that will ever make up for what you just did. That was horrible.
I just think that's hilarious. I'm sorry, but that's right. Funny.
Got him. All right. Hey, how's everybody doing other than being mad at me? Adam, how you doing?
Oh, fine. It's the holidays. I can't stay mad for long.
Sure you can, but you're on a podcast, so you have to fake it.
You just make me mad again later. It's fine.
Honestly, we're in Rock Center. All you got to do is go downstairs and get caught with
words
to people.
Come on. Joy, peace on earth, all that fun stuff.
All right.
I'm in the spirit. I don't care if you guys aren't.
Okay. This is the last podcast.
I was visited
before
by
Christmas.
Three
we'll probably mention, we'll talk about Christmas for like a hot second, but not yet.
That was it. We mentioned it. We're done. Thanks.
Oh, no.
Folks.
I'll say
happy holidays.
We'll say like a favorite Christmas song at the end or something.
Oh, my God.
Sure.
Huey, there you go. See?
It's Kwanzaa.
That's cool, too.
All right.
Hey, man.
I'm so joking.
Today is actually the winter solstice.
It is.
So bright solstice to everyone.
Yes.
Bright solstice. Yeah. See?
Light your Yule logs so nothing untoward can get into your house.
It's a safe Christmas space. Also, salt those windows. Demons like to come out during it.
What? Okay. So, gosh, this is kind of a crazy week. Big movie week.
Big movie week.
Mary Poppins Returns, Bumblebee, Aquaman, and then a lot of newsy stuff happened. Some trailers. Got your Men in Black internationally. Got your Hellboy there. And also Aladdin? Question mark? But we'll talk about all of those things in a moment. But first, we do this thing at the top of every show where we talk about what we're personally geeking out about. Adam.
Yes.
What's up with you?
I started a new book this week, which is that new. It came out in February, but it's new to me. It is called The Gone World by Tom Sweaterlish. I probably pronounced his name incorrectly. But it is basically a combination of NCIS, Cthulhu, and time travel. It's crazy.
Wow.
It's freaking crazy so far. I'm only about a third of the way through it. I just started a couple days ago, but it's bananas.
And it's called The Gone World?
The Gone World. And
I got to tell you, I'm really glad because I thought for a second you were like, hey, there's a Gone Girl shared universe.
Oh, no, it sounds like that. And there's also a book
insane.
By Nick Harkaway called The Gone Away World, which is a very good book also, but different book. So basically the premise is you got this woman who's an NCIS investigator in the 90s, except, oops, the Navy has been operating also this secret program of deep space and time travel for the past decade. So they jump around in time. But meanwhile, there's this.
So we get X-Files, JAG.
Yes.
Timeless a little bit.
Yeah. And then there's also this weird event that happens in the future called the Terminus that wipes out humanity and turns everything super weird and goth and creepy, but it starts in the far future and it keeps moving forward. So every time they jump forward in time, they're like, where's the Terminus? Oh, it's 1,000 years from now. It's 500 years from now. It's 300 years from now. So it's this weird, and it's coming, and they can't figure out what it is, and they're trying to figure out how to stop it. So,
like George Washington.
That's the basic, exactly. that's the basic premise. There's a lot more going on. It's pretty gripping. I mean, I have read a lot of these types of books, and I am very hooked. And I'm only, like I said, a third of the way through. So I'm sure there's more to come. But also, it's being adapted into a movie by Neil Blomkamp.
Oh, nice.
Well, so,
I mean, I say nice.
Well, yeah.
He's due for a good one. It's been a while.
And the source material is good. Or, you know, so anyway, if you're looking for some light holiday reading that combines murder and time travel and horrible apocalypse.
Yeah, I was going to say, does it qualify as apocalyptic fiction? I wonder.
Yeah.
But does the world actually end? See, I don't think a thing is apocalyptic fiction unless we actually get to the end of the world.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I haven't finished the book yet, so it's hard for me to say.
I'll be curious.
No spoilers, please.
Okay.
But
it'd be amazing if somehow a voice suddenly appeared in the room from a future listener who used time travel to ruin the book for you.
And that person would probably be you, if we're being honest.
If only I read.
Yeah. Anyway, The Gone World, Tom Sweaterlish. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing your name correctly, sir. Definitely good book to check out.
Cool.
If you have not yet.
Karima?
I'm geeking out actually over a few things. I got to interview Teenie Howard this week. And in doing so, you know, when you're going to interview somebody, you do a lot of research. And I've read Assassinistas, and I know about the work that she's got coming out with Valiant. But I had not picked up Euthanauts. And Euthanauts is really good. Euthanauts is basically Flatliners meets Supernatural. And it's basically about a woman, and it's through IDW. It's about a young woman named Talia who all of a sudden, through an event, gets the ability to basically, she can basically walk into the afterlife like walking across the street. Like, it's much, she should probably give lessons to Constantine because she can do it much easier. But basically what happens is it's a group of people who one person actually passes away. And as they pass away, she happens to be in the right or wrong place at the right time. And the way it works is as long as there's somebody dead whose spirit is tethered to somebody who is alive, you can pass back and forth. So it's about finding these powers, finding this whole universe, and basically working with these wacky scientist assistants that are left that basically in a Flatliners kind of way really wish they could do, you know, what she does. So it's done really well. The art is fantastic. And it's actually been getting a lot of really rave reviews. So if you get a chance, you should absolutely check it out. Also, feel free to check out my interview that's going to be on Sci-Fi soon. And then a little small thing I'm geeking out about is yesterday, December 20th, was my stroke anniversary, which for anybody who doesn't know, I had a stroke 5 years ago. And I had problems walking and with my motor skills and things like that. So for anybody who's had a stroke, you end up with a stroke-iversary, basically. And so it was one of those days where it's like you take a moment and you look around and you go, oh, wait, I'm walking. It's a good day. You know, and it's one of those, I think at the end of this year, and I've had a pretty awesome year, thanks to Sci-Fi and all you guys here, it was sort of like a moment of gratitude. And then I, you know, jump back into work like the rest of us. But I looked up long enough to go, hey, I'm still here. And that's kind of cool. So those are two things I'm geeking out.
We're also glad you're here. I'm also geeking out about the fact that you're still here.
I'm still here. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know how Danny feels.
I wasn't actually a nerd until you lived.
So that whole, I think maybe it was a different, I think between the Euthanauts thing and like the day, I think Euthanauts actually triggered that because it was looking at like death and life and sickness and stuff in the book. And I was like, huh, you know, a lot to be grateful for. So are you grateful for anything, Danny?
No. yes, of course. So I went down to my old stomping grounds of Forbidden Planet this week because Livewire number one came out. Written by a friend of the podcast, certainly longtime friend of mine.
I was going to say old coworker.
Yes, Vida Ayala. And yeah, so I interviewed them, which we'll cut to in a moment. And I read the issue. I had not gotten a copy of it yet. So I came, we had a hug, bought the comic, went in the corner of the store, read the comic, and then we talked about it for 5 minutes. It's really great. I like that Valiant is a little more hard science fiction, I feel, than, you know, because people will point out that the Harbingers are sort of the X-Men for the Valiant universe.
Yeah, the Psyots, yeah.
But the Psyots definitely have a more science fiction-y approach to them, and I think always have. I mean, I've been reading Valiant books since they had their last big boom in the 90s. But Livewire is a character has never had an ongoing before.
And I've been yelling about that for years.
I have also been yelling for years that Vita Ayala has never had an ongoing before, and so they both. It's kind of a moment of synchronicity that they both, character and creator, have now got their first ongoing series, and it's.
And
it's,
I'm happy they put, and not to give anything away in the book, but I was just happy to see the Secret Weapons team again in there, because I loved the Secret Weapons series, and those characters are so cool. When I was really excited to see what Vita was going to do with them, so.
Yeah, and you can
guys talked about that at all, but
well, you talked about, well, you know what? I won't even say. You can listen to that interview right now. So, what's this book?
Livewire is the titular character. She is a Saiyat. For those who have not had any experience in the Valiant universe, Saiyats are people who have strange and amazing abilities. So. Livewire in particular, Amanda McKee, can control technology with her mind. She is essentially Siri or Alexa, but a person. She's one of the strongest and smartest people in the Valiant universe, and this story takes place directly after Harbinger Wars 2. You don't actually have to have read that if you don't want to. I'll sum it up really quick. The government was hunting Saiyats. Livewire turned off the entire country, and that led to some... pretty intense fighting with the government itself, and now Livewire picks up right after that, where she's on the run from everybody. Old friends and enemies, the entirety of the U.S. government, I think MI6 as well. She's having a pretty rough go of it, but the series is a redemption story. It is about her having to deal with the consequences of doing something so massive.
So this is the first time she's had her own book. This is your first ongoing... What was your connection to the character before this? What's it like having your first ongoing series?
It is my first ongoing series, and that's amazing. I am so, so happy to be able to work on this book. I'm a huge fan of the character in particular. There was a series that came out pretty recently called Secret Weapons. Has the same art team, the writer was the writer of The Arrival, which is pretty amazing. And that book is... a phenomenal book that's about Livewire finding Saiyat kids and basically showing them that they're more than what they've been told. That is one of my favorite superhero team books of all time. That is one of my favorite comics that's come out in the last 5 to 10 years. It is an incredible book. And this is kind of hopefully the spiritual successor to that.
So why this story? Why was this the story that you wanted to tell with her specifically?
I've been drawn to redemption stories for a very long time. I think that there's something really interesting about a character having to admit to themselves that they have done something that needs to be made up for, that they need to atone for. And I'm very interested in starting a hero journey from there. Xena Warrior Princess is one of my favorite shows of all time. I really like The Pretender, The Fugitive, that kind of stuff. And so I wanted to tell this story for Amanda because I think she deserves to have her own book and to be... a central hero. But in order to get there, she has something to make up for, I think.
Truthful question. If you had had these powers, would you have also done what she did? Or do you feel like that's something that you would have kept yourself from doing? Because it's thorny, right? Even reading this first issue, it's sort of a question of she did a thing, she regrets the thing, but also would she do it all over again? The answer is maybe. Probably yes, although it's not said.
One of the central things for this book is to move her from a place of kind of self-righteousness to accepting that there was something very wrong with what she did. And I think if I had those powers, I'm not sure that I would have made a different choice in that moment. So the moment that she turns off the government and the country, she's lost control. She's a very controlled person, and she was, like I said, they were hunting her kids. She got real tired. And she, for one second, let herself unleash her power. And she's never done that before. I can't say that I would have done any differently. I would hope so. I would hope... One of the things that I think is very cool about her is that her powers can both be a sledgehammer and a scalpel, right? She chose the sledgehammer in that moment. There is, I believe, a way to do what she needed to do and not have so much collateral damage. And I would hope that I would do that. I can't say for sure that I would.
What do you hope people get out of this book?
I hope that they come out of this book loving her as much as I do.
It was great. Wow.
All right.
We all definitely listened to it in this moment and agreed that I am a great interviewer and Vita is a great human being. Anyway, that's what we're geeking out about. And now we can talk about the news and then we'll talk about some movies. Hey.
Unless the news is the movies.
So there was. Can we talk about Aladdin?
Sure.
Hey,
do we have to?
Yes, we do. this is unfortunately, you know, stroke-iversary be damned.
I know, right?
Now back to work, and the work unfortunately is Aladdin. So, Entertainment Weekly released a cover, and there's some sort of photos from the set inside. Kind of your first real look at what this live-action Aladdin movie is going to be. We can talk about the interior art in a moment, but the response to the cover was not good.
Well, let me ask this question.
Please.
Has there ever, and this is what I don't understand, has an Entertainment Weekly cover for an upcoming film ever done it any favors at all, ever,
It does kind of seem like they should get a new team doing
of art directors or something. Maybe the only thing I can think of that was good was that big Before Infinity War. They got like all of everybody who's ever been in the universe.
Okay.
But I honestly think Marvel art directed that. But I agree with you. And Marvel doesn't always do it right either. Because remember the first Black Panther image we saw?
Yep.
And his head was... honestly, I'm not that crazy about the new Captain Marvel poster. It looks like her head was placed on somebody else's body. Like, the trailer looked better, than the first cover.
Yeah,
like,
those Entertainment Weekly covers are always so cheesy and weird looking. And
well, and also, why would you...
Yeah.
It's weird that, you know, I didn't have beef with this, but, you know, the very first thing that everybody said was, why isn't Will Smith blue? That was the first thing I heard ad nauseum. And I thought, well, I don't really care about that. But then they said, but he will be blue in the movie. And I'm so confused as to why they would put out any version of him that wasn't blue then.
Yeah,
that's
I'm
weird.
Confused.
Like, why would you put out a cover? Like, if that's true.
And I've seen.
Well, I'm going to guess the blue is being added in post.
Yeah, that's but then they could do that in post on the cover, too. They could have made him blue.
Exactly. And the other thing that's really weird is that I've seen. Like, I got some, like, you know, Disney behind-the-scenes stuff, and none of it is him blue. So, literally, yesterday,
yeah, was
when
that
was announced.
Did they decide in that moment?
I'm wondering if they didn't just decide to do it in post.
I guess we'll do it now. I guess we will.
No, maybe
really
it was always decided in post, but it was never in any of, like, he was not painted blue in it. They didn't do a...
But it was the
he's
first...
He's not a Cree. It's not like...
Right.
No, but it was the first time that I had heard that.
Yeah.
I had heard someone say, oh, yeah, he'll be blue. And so, yeah, it really made it feel as though, and as happens, and I think we're going to wind up talking about a little bit with Aquaman, the consequence of deciding on a thing so late in the game. It's weird, right? Because what if they hadn't planned and then people complain so much? Is that good? I don't think it is. I think they should. I mean, that's a real hold your ground. Do you really does the genie really need to be blue?
I was going
to
say, I think if the movie were good.
It wouldn't matter.
Would
it really matter if he was
blue
or not? If he did a great job,
right?
That doesn't seem critical. However,
this is the type of thing that people get worked up about in this early stage of production of any film. I mean, look at the X-Men when that movie came out, and oh, why aren't their uniforms? Why isn't yellow spandex? You know, like,
well, in fairness, 18 years later, people are still mad about those costumes,
right? But I'm saying, like, but the movie was generally well received when it came out, so. Is he blue? Is he not blue? This is the type of thing that at this stage we can argue about. If the movie comes out and it's great, no one will care.
Yeah. I mean, I would say so. Yeah. The cover stuff that came out, there were a lot of jokes about the fact that Aladdin has a shirt on.
Well, there's two things. There were jokes, but honestly, from the Muslim community, these were all really, really, everybody liked this because both of those characters are supposed to be in Muslim countries, and Jasmine was always dressed not like a Muslim woman would not have a little bra top on and little like bikini pants under, like that was never allowed. So the fact that she's fully covered, her midriff is covered, actually was a positive thing that I was seeing, and the fact that he was not wearing a shirt. People who were looking more at the historical accuracy
of the
people.
You would not walk around in a desert without a shirt.
But, yes, and also physically, like where they were supposed to be,
right.
they said that just where he's from and who he is supposed to be, that he wouldn't have dressed like that. There are people that are fans of the original animation that don't like it. But there are people that were like, no, that's really cool.
Oh, man. Whose take is the hottest take? Whose take will reign supreme?
But would she wear a corset?
It's not a corset. Actually, that's the part that's really strange. It's not a corset, but that picture on the entertainment thing makes it look like it.
Yeah.
That's what's so weird.
I also don't understand that it, you know, it's blue. Like I said, this really, I don't understand. So they decided they wanted to have their cake and eat it too. No bare midriff, but we'll have a midriff-colored area.
Yeah, that was strange. That was very like, Disney on Ice, you know, when they want to make it look like that.
Is that, I mean, to me, that's homage, right? It's like, we're going to change the costume for whatever reason, whether it's cultural and historical, more approximation of accuracy, or for whatever other reason. But we're going to pay a little homage by putting like that. To me, that's fine. People just chill out, everybody. It's just a picture.
And I agree. And also culturally, I don't think that that's far off. I know Muslim women who will wear flesh colored things to basically not show, pretend that they're not wearing anything, but sort of to highlight things that match their skin tone. Now, I personally am not Muslim. I'm not speaking for the entire Muslim community. I'm just saying, again, people are freaking out before they see the actual. Honestly, I have more problems with Will Smith's like Thanos knockoff gauntlets than I do with the fact that he's not blue. The moment he was announced as the genie, I was like, I don't know. And I'm still like that.
The only thing I have to say about this whole thing is think twice before doing one of those Entertainment Weekly covers.
Yeah, don't do an Entertainment Weekly cover,
because it never works. Whenever it works.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. Like, if you look at the interior stuff, nobody was complaining about that.
Right.
No.
And in fact, really, the story is not the cover.
It's not.
The story is Jafar. That was what everyone was talking
about. Yeah, let me tell
you
right now. Yeah, I don't understand why.
Hot Jafar was the story. And I will say this.
But the sad thing is, Mina Massoud is not a bad looking dude. He just looked terrible on that cover.
Well, it's not. But that's the one thing, is it's not just the cover. And people have called that out too. The fact that they even found a picture of the woman who was doing his hair.
Yeah.
And how she just burned it up.
Yeah. Like, this is what I'm just showing the guys in the room. This is what Mina Massoud Aladdin is normally looks like.
You act like I didn't know.
No, I know.
But what's wrong with Hot Jafar?
No, Jafar is amazing.
There's nothing wrong with Hot Jafar.
But they're saying, why can't they make Aladdin look as hot? They straightened
out his hair, and they did a really not great job of it. And a lot of people said that was, and they shaved his beard off, and they said they just kind of, you know, they, I don't know if it's for me to say that he was whitewashed, but that is a thing that people said.
Again, though, this is a cover thing. Entertainment Weekly covers are always lit very, very bright. They lighten everybody's skin tone. So I don't want to say that Disney did it, because I think it's Entertainment Weekly.
They did something bad to his hair, though. Anyway.
Speaking of bad hair, Hellboy.
Oh, boy. Got him. Oh, boy. Hellboy.
You made me a damn weapon. I just wanted to help you become the best you. Some dads get their kids Legos.
So
hell hair.
The trailer drop.
Yeah.
What'd you think of it?
Middling, I guess. I had the same reaction. It's hard to divorce yourself from Ron Perlman as Hellboy.
It is.
I mean, he's so, whether the movies, I think the movies were of wildly varying quality, but like, he in that role was just great and iconic, and his look was iconic.
And David Harbour's good. We're not saying that.
The makeup is just different. It's jarring a little bit, no matter what else I thought about the trailer. There were parts I thought were really cool. There's some imagery that's lifted straight out of the comics that I thought was great. Liv Tyler looks awesome. I'm here for her as an evil witch. Still, I'm a big Hellboy fan, so I'm still going to see it regardless. I wouldn't say the trailer made me thrilled and oh my god, I can't wait to see this movie, holy crap, but it also did not turn me off.
I think for me it was weird, because I was doing the same thing. I was trying to divorce myself from two things. One, my image of the previous, I kept looking for Abe Sapien. I also had an interview earlier this year with Mike Mignola, who talked about how much he did not like the first movie, and how the second one really was gonna be the he just felt it the last one did not get evil enough and get dark enough and get messy enough.
I 100% agree with that, actually.
And he was putting his stamp on this new one coming out. So I was looking for that, and then it was weird. It was like kind of jokey at the beginning.
Yeah, the tone
of
the trailer did not convey that.
Right.
That this is a darker, more horror or influenced film, for sure.
That's the first thing that I was... And I had to watch it a couple times. And then Daniel Day came with a British accent. I also had to go back and handle. And then it was, Hellboy's Gene Simmons hair. I was like, okay, I'm not watching this trailer anymore. I'm going to wait till the movie comes out.
Here's what I know. The dead giveaway that the movie's going to be darker. Hellboy's got bad teeth. Dead giveaway. I will say, really, because, you know, he's got the chiclet teeth, the Ron Perlman version, and he's got, you know, haven't been to the dentist ever, looks like I still got baby teeth in here kind of mouth. And I don't know, that just seems depressing to me. So I thought maybe it'll get really dark. And the teeth suggest a darkness that we've not yet seen. Anyway, I guess it's kind of a wait and see. I mean, like, it was directed by the man that made The Descent, so it's probably going to be pretty dark.
I mean, it's
gonna
be funny, but I guess for me, I was looking for, like, HBO Spawn levels of dark.
Right.
And I'm like, oh.
Yeah, no, that is a very good point. The trailer had a tone that was very, like, rollicking, fun, Aerosmith soundtrack, you know, type of thing, and that is not the tone that we've been told this movie is going for. So it'll be interesting to see
how
the final
product
matches up.
If they go the Devilman Crybaby route, which looks really lighthearted and fun and then gets very dark and very messy and murderous and crazy very quickly, then maybe that's, you know, that's the Hellboy that.
Maybe the first trailer was just to try and pull in the people that like the Guillermo del Toro version, which was a little more like that. And then in the later trailers, it'll look more dark. Maybe it's like they have some kind of a plan, even.
I just need them to fix his hair. That's all. I need that wig gone.
There's still time.
I don't think there is.
No.
Hey, here we go. One more trailer.
Yeah.
Speaking of not having more time, another trailer drop, and that is Men in Black International.
We are the Men in Black.
Yes.
You felt good about that.
I did. First of all, I wasn't quite sure. I was like, did we need another Men in Black? I didn't know we needed another one. But
it
with this
once.
Team up, right? With this team up,
three wasn't
I'm
bad.
Not mad. Yeah, mm. Three wasn't bad. Mm. I'm not mad at this team up, though.
No.
I like this. And, you know, I don't know. Tessa could do whatever she wants as far as I'm concerned. But I just thought it was, it's been a minute since we've seen Helmsworth really funny, even though a lot of people swear he was super funny in Thor. I think seeing him although the hammer joke at the end of the trailer was hitting you over the head. I'm excited for it.
There should be a big red button around here somewhere.
Found it.
Again, I am very excited for the concept of this film. I'm very excited for who's involved. I will say this trailer didn't up that excitement significantly. I didn't come out of it thinking like, oh yes, it's working. I'm more so kind of like, oh gosh, I hope this still works. I don't know what it is. I think it's just,
I wasn't ready for Qui-Gon though.
Yeah, man. I mean, the cast is amazing. Like,
it was.
Liam Neeson, Emma Thompson.
Yeah.
Friggin'
see, this is
Tessa
the thing.
Thompson,
everyone,
all the Thompsons.
Yes.
The Thompson
the
twins.
Everybody's talking. I mean, listen, I'm excited about Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth too, but listen to me, friends. Liam Neeson and Emma Thompson together, just like old times. I was like, is this it's Men in Black meets Love Actually.
Oh, God.
They're in that movie
Do
together.
You really have to bring that movie up?
I did.
I didn't make that connection
Christmas
to this
time.
Very
that's
moment.
That's a Christmas movie.
And now I can't unsee it.
But yeah, that's the first thing I thought. I was like, Men in Black International is also Love Actually, too.
It's possible.
There you go. I want them to actually, that's who they are. They're
just
actually the same characters.
Yeah.
But
she grabbed Alan Rickman finally and joined
and
the
Liam
Men
Neeson,
in Black,
it didn't work out with what's her face, who is in the movie, who was just a model.
Right.
I just want to see her toss back a bottle of rum in like black leather like she did as Valkyrie, and then I'll be happy.
Oh, okay. I mean, there was a great Twitter post that was her with big guns.
Yes.
It was like Tessa Thompson with giant guns. That's it. That's the post.
Yeah.
And then I can't wait till the goat meme. I don't know if everybody knows about the Tessa Thompson goat meme thing. And she's in on it now. But somebody
she's been in on it.
Somebody basically takes scenes that she's done and things that she's in and replaces it with a real life goat doing whatever it is. So she's climbing. If she's climbing in a scene, they'll find a goat climbing a mountain. But she's now in on it and will contribute her own goat memes.
That's awesome.
So I can't wait to see the goat meme that comes out of this trailer from her.
But my confidence is still high. While this trailer did not blow me away, my confidence in the movie is still high. I think with that cast, Hemsworth and Thompson have good chemistry. We already know that on screen. F. Gary Gray is a very competent director. I wouldn't say he's
underrated,
an auteur, but... He knows how to make a movie.
Authorship is not really that important, let's be honest.
Yeah. I mean, it was just funny seeing this trailer from the director of The Fate of the Furious. And I'm thinking, really? That's Gary Gray's legacy
that's
now?
That's what I'm saying. That's what they gave him because he's done other things.
Yeah, he's done a lot of other good films. Friday doesn't count anymore, I guess. No one cares about Friday.
Knows.
But
Dark Days.
Yeah, it's a weird time. But
But
all of that put together makes me think that this is going to be an enjoyable film.
Hey,
yeah,
we should talk about movies, but before we do that,
yes,
a word from our sponsors.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Are you ready to pop off?
I hope so. What are we talking about first?
Mary Poppins Returns.
I was going to say, I never know where Danny's going, and I didn't want to answer until I knew what direction.
All right.
Mary
Poppins, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
I actually sat next to Adam at the screening, so I have proof that he liked it.
Oh, okay.
I found it delightful.
He smiled. I saw this one
even
weeks ago.
A couple times.
I saw this one a while. Yeah, I cried almost the whole way through. I loved Mary Poppins Returns. I think it was maybe Leonard Maltin or one of those really classic reviewer guys who said, for a movie that I was angry at, that a movie that shouldn't even exist, I still really liked it.
Yeah. I mean, it was interesting. I actually saw an online debate about that where a review on, I believe it was the AV Club, where the reviewer just went in on them saying, this is totally a cash grab. They're only doing this to make money. And I'm thinking to myself,
literally every movie.
It's a major studio film. Of course they're trying to make money. That is like, what movie out there, they're just like, no, we're putting out Aquaman for the art of it. No, they're trying to make money. Come on. So
yes, and also furthermore, why did you think the first Mary Poppins movie was made? They looked and said, in fact, there's a whole movie about it.
Yeah.
It's called Saving Mr. Banks. Look into it. But I mean, it's nice. They certainly add a little bit of heart to it, but they wanted to make some money, friends, and they succeeded.
Yes.
And that's what it's the same.
Emily Blunt is having a moment.
She is. 2018 is her year.
With The Quiet Place in this.
Yeah.
She's outstanding in this movie.
I mean, it's to say that she did something totally different and yet still iconic. Because that's the thing. You watch it and I don't want to say you forget Julie Andrews because that seems impossible, but very distinctly, Emily Blunt is not trying to be Julie Andrews,
right,
but she is Mary Poppins.
She honestly just seems like, and Danny will appreciate this, she literally seems like a reincarnated Time Lord. She's the next Mary Poppins. This is her iteration of it, staying within, and her TARDIS is her umbrella. And
so what's the deal with, here's the question my wife asked. We rewatched their first Mary Poppins last night. So what's the deal with Bert? Is he an exiled Time Lord? What's the deal? Was he a companion? Like, what happened? What's the story there? Because I think at this point, I'm shocked that Doctor Who has never actually entertained this and just said it out loud. But Mary Poppins is a Time Lord. I don't, like, that just seems beyond debate. She's got a bag that's bigger on the inside than it is on the outside.
What would cause any indication that Bert is in any way anything other than human?
The fact that
he knows Mary Poppins.
He knows who she is. They have the whole bit where, I mean, I guess he paints the things and he is unable to do the magic, but he can almost do it. But I don't know. It's a question of how old you think he is. I mean, certainly he's the one that sort of resolves that story at the end. The first Mary Poppins film is, it's oddly, it's not Mary Poppins takes you on the journey, but it's Dick Van Dyke that sort of puts all the pieces in together at the end when he's talking to Mr. Banks.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, I guess maybe he's a former companion of the Doctor's a former companion of the Time Lord that is Mary Poppins.
There you go.
That works.
Yeah.
So many people won't. There are so many people, like, think about when that movie came out. There's like two generations practically of people who this is their first Mary Poppins.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's Emily Blunt. That's been on my mind too, which is, I think we all agree that we liked it. But
I thought the lamplight versus chimney sweep thing, that update was cute.
Yeah.
But not all the updates made it. Like some of the it wasn't skateboarding, biking.
The BMX biking stuff.
I'm like, okay, wait.
All right, so here, I have two.
Some updates didn't work.
Let me say, I have two criticisms of this film that are neither of them killers in my mind, but there were two things that jumped out at me. One, so the whole setup is, you know, you got these Banks children, they're older now. Michael's wife has passed away. And there's a very poignant moment at the beginning where he's singing in the attic about her and everything. And that's really great. But I felt like the first film had this thread of melancholy running through it that was missing here a little bit. That moment was melancholy, and that was it's a really well executed moment, I thought. But overall, it just, you didn't feel the weight of London as much, I think, as you did in the first movie. And then, and this is me, I'm a huge music person, and while the music in this movie is good, I don't think anything in it measures up to what's in the first film, which is not a slight against the movie. It's just hard. I mean, the first movie's music is stone classic, iconic. It's some of the best movie music ever written. So to say it doesn't measure up to that is I'm not damning it that much. You know, it's just not. And you can tell too, because there's these moments in the score where they weave in little snippets of the original music. And like, and maybe part of it also is the fact that I grew up with this and it's been a part of my life for my entire life.
Yeah.
But
unless you were born prior to 1962.
Yeah. You just get shivered. You're just hearing that little thread of Feed the Birds or something we woven through. You're just like, whoa. And I just can't see any of the songs from this movie achieving like the cultural penetration or classic status of something like Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious or Let's Go Fly a Kite or something like that. It's just, but again, it's you're asking it to measure up to something that's profoundly almost perfect.
Well, so, I also think that this
perfect
is
in every way. That's it. That's the only two criticisms I had against this movie.
But in terms of the movie, in terms of music, just for tying that in really quick, the most of the music was done and even performed by Lin-Manuel Miranda, and this is Mary Poppins for the Hamilton set. So there's a lot of,
well, there's definitely one song in particular.
Well, that's absolutely from Hamilton. Yeah, it's like not from Hamilton, but it's very similar.
But see,
in
it's
style.
Interesting.
It's actually, I think it's In the Heights. It's more similar to.
Are you talking
about
the book by its cover?
Yeah.
Song.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
like
interesting.
In
but someone, I saw another reviewer, someone called that. Oh, they threw in a rap verse, and I'm thinking,
so
that's not that different than what you'd hear in Gilbert and Sullivan. It's not rap. It's just singing.
Yeah.
And it's
not
like it's being done the way that Lin-Manuel does it.
Yeah.
But that's, I don't like, I saw people complain about that
there's people in Rent who did that. Why do you care?
No,
I'm
going to
say there's people
about
in The Pirates of Penzance who do that.
Exactly.
You know, this is not a new invention.
Art form.
I mean, it's funny. I just watched the second season of Hip Hop Evolution, which is a documentary series on Netflix, and which is great, by the way. Anyone should check that out. But
So it's the Great British Bake Off and
Hip Hop Evolution. But they talk a little bit about these early influences like Cab Calloway and all this stuff that were doing things that sounded like rap, you know, century ago. So it does not feel out of place. It doesn't feel like, oh, we're having this British Victorian, you know, music and suddenly there's a hardcore West Coast rap verse in it. It feels very much of a piece to me.
It does. But for you, there was no song that was like Frozen. There was no right. song that's like, this is the song.
I mean, the only one I've been able to honestly hum to myself or sing to myself was the Trip to Light Fantastic and just that line pretty much.
I mean, I thought that song was okay.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I think for what it is, which is basically an homage, I felt like this was a beautiful homage to the original. It is not the original. I do agree with some of the criticisms of like, they shouldn't have tried to do so many things that were updates of other things, meaning like the lamplighters versus the chimney sweeps. Right. They should have just done a whole other thing. That's to be okay. That's to be expected. But I don't think it was executed in a bad way. The only thing that threw me off for a minute was the BMX biking.
Right.
And it wasn't that long. This movie is not about BMX biking and Mary Poppins.
No. It's one bit in one song.
Yeah, I was like, eh.
Because the Learys, the lamplighters all ride bikes around town. And suddenly also, their bikes have really fat tires and can do tricks.
Yes, but Lin-Manuel Miranda has shown me that I can put six people on a two-wheel bike with a ladder.
Well, and I like the way they updated a lot of the stuff. It's like the children, Michael Banks's children are not the Banks children from the first film.
They are not.
They're different in the fact that they've had to spend time without a mother. They're a little more self-sufficient. They're a little more cynical, you know? And so it doesn't retread the same story that the first one did.
No, there are beats that are similar. Yes. Yeah. You know that scene where they go and visit that dude and every time he laughs, he like flies up to the ceiling. Well, the Meryl Streep bit is very similar. And there's a number of things where you go, just like you said, the lamplighters and the chimney sweeps. It's you know, Trip to Light Fantastic is kind of like Step in Time, right. In a way. And and there's even, there's a, the Royal Dalton Music Hall. There's parts of that that have a lot of like fast talky, which reminds me a little bit of Supercalifragilistic to a degree. So you see there are parallels, but yes, there's stuff that I do think makes a difference. I don't know if I agree that it's less melancholy because yes, the plot, that's the thing. Mary Poppins, I like very much. Mary Poppins does not really have a plot. Mary Poppins Returns 100% has a plot. There is a specific stake that carries you through. Every time they're doing a thing, every little subplot that they do is on the journey towards dealing with this particular stake. And so I think that is actually a huge improvement. Yes, I do think the Banks children in this have a very different vibe to them that, again, add sort of this element of plot and character that I just don't think that you quite get from the Banks kids in the first movie. And, I guess my question is, Bumblebee's out, Aquaman's out, Into the Spider-Verse is out. Is this movie going to work? Is it going to make money? Like, this is sort of the big question that's on my mind.
You have to take your grandparents to see something.
Well, and listen, I think...
like, grandma's not going to see a movie.
But how much of a stake is that? That's my question, is how successful will this movie be?
But I think the thing is that all three... maybe not Aquaman, but no, I'm saying not in terms of the quality, what I think about the film, but about whether it's suitable for children.
Yes.
All three of these Aquaman movies is on about as close. Some level. It's still got some stuff that I would say.
That's
Bumblebee
true.
More so, but this movie, I think, is the most, I mean, it's a kid's movie. And like, that was one of the things about with the plot. The plot does, not to give spoilers away, but there's some Pat stuff in there and it wraps up a little easily, but it's not Citizen Kane. This is a kid's movie. And so that's why I think it has a chance of success, because especially around the holidays, you're looking for parents are going to remember Mary Poppins and want to go see it for that. And they can bring their kids with no worries whatsoever that it's going to in any way be.
Honestly, if it was just.
You're missing one movie, though, and that is Nutcracker. And I've seen Nutcracker, and I honestly think the only competition that Mary Poppins has is Nutcracker, and Nutcracker can't live up to this.
Well, Nutcracker's are also already out of theaters.
Right, but that was the
but that's
at
what
one
I'm saying,
point
but,
they
but
did
not,
cross.
But
so
Nutcracker did not make a lot of money. No. I don't
it
think.
And but it had a creepy story about with the mother who died and
Here's what I'm saying. If it was just Bumblebee, Aquaman, and this, I would say, I think it'd be all right. Really, to me, the issue is that Spider-Verse is out there. And Spider-Verse is the one, man. That movie is going to make a lot of money this Christmas season because people don't just want to see it. People want to rewatch it over. You know, how many people have you heard say, I've seen it 2, 3, 4 times?
But it's still I don't want to say it's a violent film because it's not violent in the sense of, you know, there's blood flying everywhere, but it's a film with action and antagonists and blah, 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 which up to a certain point, a lot of parents aren't comfortable with. You can take your 5-year-old to see Mary Poppins. And that's the thing I think that is going to help this movie is that, you know, you
yeah,
can
there's
take
some things that I don't think a 5-year-old should see Spider-Man in the Spider-Verse.
Right.
Yeah.
And which is not against the film, but it's just it's a different kind of movie. And if you're looking for a movie that you can take your kids to, that you're going to enjoy because you grew up with Mary Poppins, but also they're going to enjoy and you don't have to worry about them getting scared or, you know, traumatized or whatever. Yeah. This is a great one to do it. So I don't know. I mean, it's a good question whether this will actually take off and.
It's just sharing the box office with a lot.
It's a crowded season.
Yeah,
it's a very crowded season.
It's the most crowded I can think of a Christmas season being.
I think because this is the first year in a minute that there's been no Star Wars or Marvel Cinematic MCU movie that everybody was like, all the things.
Yeah. Everybody get out of the way so this thing can come out. Yeah.
But you brought up Bumblebee.
I did. You want to talk about the bees?
I would love to talk about Bumblebee.
Bumblebee, there is only one way to end this war. You must protect Earth and its people.
Do we all like it?
I loved it.
I thought it was fantastic. The only thing, I have one issue. But
wait, before you get can I ask another question?
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody in this room liked a Transformers movie before?
No.
No.
Okay.
In my mind, this is that's not true. I enjoyed the animated film from 1986 when I was 11 years old.
You're talking about like
the new
action.
But no,
that's what I'm saying.
In my mind, it's not even close. It's not even in the same ballpark that this is the best Transformers movie.
The funny thing is, Michael Bay is involved with this movie. He's got producer credit. And I felt it a little bit in there, but he was not directing. But I did feel a
little of him.
I felt a little bit of him in the movie, but. Yeah, whatever they did, we're like, please, for the love of God, do it again. Because this was
well, and this is the thing. It's interesting. I texted you guys last night after I saw this. It's everything I loved about this movie makes it hard for me to see them making a sequel that works. Because what's great about it is, and people have said this, is that it's this small personal story about, for the most part, one Transformer and one girl and their relationship. And that's what makes it good. To me, in a lot of ways, most of the things that are good about this movie come from that. And so you start bringing a bunch of other Transformers into it and having a war and stuff. That's when I start to worry that, you know, it's going to lose that element. I mean, this is practically an Amblin film, you know, it's set in the 1980s, which first of all, the other thing that blew my mind is watching the film. If I was watching this when I was growing up, this would have been set in the 1950s. Because this is all 30 years ago.
And then it would have been Iron Giant.
But so that blew my mind. But so, yeah, it's got that 80s suburban family, you know, of thing going on that Spielberg really laid into with E.T. and Poltergeist and stuff like that. And just does it really well. I was stunned. And I'm a guy who loves giant robots. And I remember going into the first Transformers movie. I was sitting there thinking, I know this is a Michael Bay film. I'm probably going to find it pretty dumb. As long as there's giant robot action, I'm going to walk out happy. And I somehow still walked out unhappy. And this is kind of fulfills
Made
the potential
that.
That I was looking for in that.
For me, I had the same thing. It was fun in a way that I didn't expect it to be. I also think that's the other thing. Was the bar so low that we're excited because the bar has now gotten to
I don't think
normal?
So.
But I actually thought that all of it was done really well. Again, with a dead parent. I'm seeing a theme here. But besides the fact that Angela Bassett was a triple-changing Decepticon, and I'm here for this, half of my childhood, and I spent a lot of time fighting with my brothers over the Transformers. And I was actually a big fan of the animated series. And then I was old enough to not be as freaked out when they in the animated movie when they killed...
Optimus Prime
and half the Autobots. But I thought the way they dealt with Bumblebee and how close it was to that movie was very cool. Like, I liked starting on
Cybertron.
I liked not seeing the whole war, but seeing remnants of it. I think that Christina Hodson, who is a writer, I think she did an amazing job. I think that if they were going to do another movie in the series, they should MCU it and find another Autobot to do a story about, or even an Decepticon.
The rumor on the street is that they were going to do an Optimus movie. Just Optimus.
Yeah, that'd be good.
They need to hurry up and do an Optimus movie because the voiceover.
Peter Cullen. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't.
I did miss Frank Welker in this movie.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, man. But, well, that'd be good. I mean, I'm down for that. But it was also set in the 1980s and it almost feels like a retread. I don't know. The other thing I will say is that, man, and Danny and I were talking about this before we recorded, the difference in the, I don't want to call it stunt choreography and direction to this because these are all CGI robots, but the fight scenes and the battle scenes and the action scenes between this and
any other Transformers movie
is so night and day. You can follow everything that's going on.
Yeah.
It's actually really interesting combat. Like, is someone who geeks out about fight choreography?
Michael Bay used to go into extreme close-ups, and then you'd come out and there'd be an explosion.
And a million cuts.
So you wouldn't see exactly what was happening.
And you get these long takes of Bumblebee executing all these, like, cool, not, I don't want to say these martial arts kung fu moves, but it shows you everything in there. Yeah.
It's great.
Like, I was really, he fights Angela Bassett's, I can't remember her name.
Shatter
in this movie at one point, and I'm just sitting there watching it, and this is like one of the best fight scenes I've seen at the movies this year.
Yeah.
In a year that also contained Black Panther and Avengers and other stuff. So I was really impressed by the way they handled that this time around.
And I did the same thing. I had a moment where I was like, they're not cutting away.
Yeah.
We're actually going to see this fight, you know.
Yeah, I love a visual narrative. Great. It is a huge difference. I definitely don't want to minimize it. It's just what a sad state that you have to say, wow, there was a visual narrative that I could follow.
Well,
I mean, it's also good, but it became a bit of a rarity. I, again, find myself wondering, how's this movie going to do? Because remember, the Transformers movies, for a hot minute, despite how the people in this room have felt,
oh, of course,
they were billion-dollar movies. Yeah. So here's a question.
Well, they made money for different reasons, though. Like the last two, the ones, especially when Wahlberg got involved, those made money because they were co-produced with a Chinese holding company, and they put Chinese stars, action stars, musicians, actors in them, so that they were thinking like internationally. That, because I remember sitting there looking at a couple of those movies, like, I don't understand how this made all this money. Yeah. And then I saw
all the movies made huge amounts of money overseas. Like even from the beginning, the first one was a huge hit overseas. So
I don't think this one wasn't that formulaic. Will it make that money? I don't know.
That's what I'm saying. Well, so here's, I find as far as international market goes, the what it used to be at least, and I think always will be to a degree, is how much can you understand without knowing the language? You know, it's why I remember when Inside Out and the Minions movie came out in the same year, and Minions made a lot more money than Inside Out did.
Sure.
I don't think anybody is here to tell you that Minions is the better movie. But the thing is that the Minions, you're not required to speak any language at all to understand what the Minions are about, because they speak gobbledygook, but in a way that you can basically grasp. And I think that it's the same for a lot of those Transformers movies, is that it's just big robots running around. You know, as a person, I think, I don't understand this visual narrative, but it almost becomes irrelevant in a way. Whereas this, I think it is a pretty simple story. I will say that they don't, you know, a thing that I had criticized, you know, quietly in my own house the first time I watched it was, you know, this character that Hayley Steinfeld plays, Charlie, you know, this car turns into a robot and she is shocked for about 2 minutes.
Yeah, I never thought she was. I never thought she was like her neighbor, played by Jorge Lindenborg Jr. He had the appropriate response, screaming his head off when he first.
Yeah, and he continued to be really weird about it for a minute, but she got over it so fast.
Yeah,
and
I thought was weird.
It's weird storytelling wise, but at the same time, I believe this is a movie picked towards kids. And I think it is also pitched towards the international community, which is to say, we don't need to spend a lot of time on the nuance of this.
Right.
She's going to get used to this robot anyway, so just cut all the bullshit and let's just have her light this robot.
Yeah. I mean, Elliot was only scared of E.T. for a hot minute. And
yeah, I mean, I think the difference is that
to come into the house,
Elliot is so young, and I think really young. Anyway,
yeah.
I wonder about that. Again, it's the same question as, how is this going to perform in a big
holiday season? That does bring up, though, I want to give it up for the human performances in this movie as well, on top of the robots, because
I'm
sold on her, Haley Steinfeld.
Yeah, because she did this. She's Spider-Gwen.
I can't remember that movie that she was in. The Edge of Something. It was a teen coming-of-age movie that was really, really good, and she was good in it. Honestly, watching the trailers, the way the dialogue was edited in the trailers, I was a bit like, is this going to work? But she's great. The woman who played her mother, who unfortunately I don't have her name in front of me, was great. And
that was
captured
Pamela Adlin.
The 80s suburban mom.
The thing about her, though.
I'm glad that she's getting work, because her thing was all linked up with Louis C.K. for a long time.
Oh,
it was,
no.
Yeah. The thing about her, though, and the family, the brother and stuff, that was her family felt. That's where I felt Michael Bay's hand in it. They felt very Witwicky. Like some
oh, really?
Of the goofy. Yeah, no, I got,
they felt
I got
very
the wiki-
Spielberg to me. That felt very Spielberg 80s to me.
I just thought, like, some of their reactions and some of the just the physical humor. I don't know. But maybe all of that was Spielberg. I don't know.
Yeah.
But that was where I felt Michael Bay's hand. But she was funny. I thought that Jorge, the neighbor, he was underused.
Yeah.
I just felt like I want to see what was left on the cutting room floor, because I did like him. I just didn't feel like they used him. He was sort of there for her to go, here, hold this. Like that. So that kind of that is only the only criticism I would have there. But
yeah,
everybody else.
John Cena was great.
Yep.
I'm here for John Cena's burgeoning cinematic career.
I was not ready for him to be good. I thought he was going to annoy me like Josh DeHamel.
All-time best lines in a Transformers movie that I don't want to give away because it's a great laugh
okay.
line.
Okay. It is a great laugh line, though. When he said it, I was like, that is perfect.
Finally. You're like, finally.
Somebody says this. Yeah.
Anyway, so that
and
was cool.
Everybody will know what it is when they hear it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one movie we do know is already doing great and is probably going to be the movie that takes the Christmas holiday.
In the wrong hands, it would bring destruction. But in the hands of the true heir, it would unite all our kingdoms, above and below.
Is Aquaman.
More like Blockwaman.
Wow.
Thank
so
you.
In case anybody
I'm so
didn't
glad
know,
I got to say that.
A real shock
doesn't know, I don't. Sorry. In case anybody doesn't realize it, Adam was not thrilled with this movie.
With Aquaman.
That's
so anyway, so Aquaman, but Aquaman is doing very well in China already. It's been, I think, for 2 weeks in certain international audiences, and it's made a lot of money. And here's the thing. That is sort of been the meme, right? Everyone says, I don't know if it's an intellectual movie, I don't know if it's a great movie, but it's a fun movie. That has been the cultural conversation.
Sure.
And neither Adam nor I felt that way.
That is correct. I did not have fun watching this film.
I had fun for about half an hour.
Do you want me to go on my rant? I can go on a rant.
All right. Okay. Get it out the way and then we can sort of...
I'm going to... Jason Momoa is a log who is fun in small doses but can't carry a movie. Amber Heard doesn't do much better. Their chemistry is practically non-existent. There's a love montage in the middle of this film that feels like it was written and directed by a 10-year-old boy. Nothing makes sense. There's no internal logic. We're supposed to take... the movie doesn't know whether it wants to be camp or a self-referential goof or a picaresque action movie or a serious meditation on heroism. So it just up and whiffs on all of them. James Wan doesn't care because look at this guy saying his name from the comic books. Black Manta doesn't need to be in this movie at all. He could be cut from the film without affecting it in the slightest. And I think... And I was bored. I was bored the entire time. I was bored by the big... this is what I say. I sleep with a white noise machine, so maybe I associate loud, constant, meaningless noise with unconsciousness, and that's why I wanted to fall asleep during this film, because it is boring. It is so big and loud and colorful and boring from start to finish. The end. Okay. I'm done.
I think... I understand why it's going to make a lot of money. And
me too.
But I went in there not expecting a Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse. Like I went in there. No, at the same time, was it a fun ride? Yes. Was it worth the money I spent? I think I would have rather have watched it on a coast to coast flight.
It was worth every penny I paid because I paid zero.
And well, but basically, I agree with you to a certain extent with it was a wrong use of Black Manta. I was very surprised to see Michael Beach show up in this film. I'm not going to tell you where he is. But I felt that that was a really horrible use of a really great actor. Anybody could have done his role. And I was like, why? Oh, wow. Okay. Maybe paycheck. I don't know. But they set up Black Manta to be, and it's funny because I kind of felt the same way about Luke Cage season one. Too many bad guys, and they just got rid of one early for another one. So I feel like that story, I wanted to see more of that and what he went through, and even just I wanted to see that developed a little bit more.
Venom from Spider-Man 3 in this film.
Yeah, exactly. He's the Topher Grace of this movie. And so basically, what I did, and then I didn't feel like I saw enough of Ocean Master. Ocean Master just looked like a Kamen Rider extra.
You sure laughed when that mask came on. That's what I remember. The mask came on and you cracked up.
Wait, Ocean Master?
Ocean Master's mask. Yeah.
It looks so ridiculous.
That's what I'm saying. It looks like a Kamen Rider extra.
And this is the
extra.
Thing is that we all are supposed to just geek out when he says, call me Ocean Master. Like, it's, oh my God, he said his name from the comic books. Whoa. Like, yeah. That's not enough to make a film.
It's also a pretty goofy name.
It's so goofy. The thing. Like, and goofiness is fun. Thor Ragnarok was goofy as hell. But
I know
this movie just can't decide. Like, at one point, I was thinking to myself, this is kind of like Flash Gordon-esque. But then I'm like, this does not have the camp. It doesn't dive into the camp.
Yeah, it doesn't know what it wants to be.
The way that Flash Gordon does. So
they should win something Breathe.
Adam
go to your happy
winded.
Place.
Yeah.
They should win something for, even though not everybody agrees with the technology or the set design, I do think they should win something for it. Because when they do have some of the big monster fight scenes or whatever, I do think that some of those designs were gorgeous.
I thought the underwater stuff looked pretty cool.
It did. Now, did it
and
mesh
with
the stuff?
And it's the first time that people have done stuff like that.
Right. And did it mesh with the stuff that was in our world? No, not at all. Was there a seamless in
just
and out of
just make an
them?
Animated film. If you're
it
gonna
wasn't.
Like this is 90% an animated film underwater.
That
like,
is actually
no...
what I thought. Because DC does so much better with animation that I felt that if this was an animated film, I would have loved it.
And the thing is, like, there's these moments, like, there's no weight to any of the action. Like, some of the battle scenes, hundreds of people are dying. Do you feel it? Nope. It doesn't matter.
Right.
There's a scene early on, and we've seen some of this in the trailers, where this big warship gets overturned by a wave. Literally hundreds of people died in that moment. Does it matter? No.
Well,
it's
no, I said that in the beginning.
In
the one that you saw in the trailer with him pushing the submarine up to the surface, I remember saying this. When I saw it in the trailer, and then it totally was driven home in the movie, all the people that he saved would have been unconscious because they would have had the bends.
No, they don't. Submarines are pressurized.
But they came up too quick.
But it doesn't
the
matter.
Pressure,
it doesn't matter
doesn't
when
the
you're in a submarine.
Change?
Not when you're in a pressurized environment.
Ugh.
But the thing is that, but that's also not how submarines work. You can't just take a submarine and put it on the surface and it floats. It's full of ballast and that
that's
makes
what I'm
it
saying.
Sink.
Like, something
so,
would have made it sink again.
So yeah, but that's I'm not looking for that level of logic in the movie. The thing one that bothered me was that, you know, we've seen in the trailer and in the clips, Aquaman and Mira jump out of a plane in the desert without parachutes, land, and they're fine. Later on, they're being chased across the rooftops of Venice, which we've also seen. So this isn't a spoiler. Aquaman slips and he's going to fall off the roof of a, say, 5-story building. And it's treated as this big, like, whoa, I have to grab this ledge and save myself moment. But he just fell out of a plane and landed fine.
Yes.
And he's worried about, so there's just no internal logic whatsoever. There's things just happen to make,
well, they make it. So they swap. Movie Bob said it was a previs the movie because you could feel where they had already come up with all of the visual designs. They'd spent the money on what things were ultimately going to be.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then scripts changed in some ways, but there were a lot of things they couldn't change. And so you see that it's like too many movies in this movie.
Yeah.
And one of the ways in which it becomes really obvious is Arthur is dumb in the beginning. He's kind of a dummy. They make a point of him being kind of goofy. And Mira's very smart. And yet somehow there is a moment in the movie where Arthur knows which one of these statues is a king and Mira eats a flower.
Yes.
What?
Yeah.
I don't, it's very, and that's, and what's funny is that that's the only part of the movie that I did like. What happens is they, that whole desert sequence, the part where they're in Venice or wherever, has got a very Romancing the Stone mm-hmm. quality to it. And that's the part of the movie that actually feels we're getting somewhere. These characters are getting to know each other. They're on a specific quest. But then we're in Star Wars The Phantom Menace underwater, and that's weird and feels disjointed and feels completely disconnected from that Romancing the Stone thing that I just watched. And you know what else feels really disconnected from everything else? The stuff with Arthur's parents.
Yeah.
Another story that I had an interest in, I thought, man, I kind of like that. I kind of wish it was just their story.
I didn't like the de-aging that they did of his dad in the beginning.
No.
It looked unfinished.
I love Samara Morrison, too, as an actor.
No, I do, too. It was, from in a post-production standpoint, I was like, they're missing, like, a layer. Like, he was too smooth, and then when the sun hit him, it didn't look right.
Here's my other favorite thing about this film. When I say favorite, that's in quotation marks.
Yes.
I counted six, I think, legitimately six scenes where you've got people talking and then an explosion happens from the side of the frame and the bad guys come in from there.
Yeah.
That literally happens.
Like, so
it happens,
close to them,
it happens,
like,
with his parents
yep.
when they come in the beginning. It happens in another
Venice.
Scene where they're meeting under the sea. It happens in Venice, or I'm sorry, it's Sicily. It happens over and over again to the point where I had to start counting because it was like, this is the shorthand for, okay, it's time for action now. We're going to have a little bit of dialogue scene and then the wall is going to explode from the side and the bad guys are going to come in and we're going to fight. And like that's, I don't want to say James Wan is lazy because the guy, I think, you know, there's a ton of effort you can feel in this movie from him. And he's done good work before, but it just felt lazy. It felt like over and over again, you see that same thing happening.
I don't know. This is
to the point where I wonder if it was intentional. Like, were you trying? Is this a trope that you were trying to create in this film or something, or a theme?
I don't know.
I feel like he
has a third act problem. If you look at his horror movies, the third act is always an issue. If you look at something like Insidious 2, the whole thing is a mess. Honestly, I don't want to call it laziness, but James wanted to do a lot.
Yes,
and he did everything.
I honestly feel like Warner Brothers got caught up in a lot of this. There was a changing of hands. Like, there's so many things that happened business-wise while this movie was being made. I just felt like it was rewritten into, like, to come out to be what we ended up
right.
with, which I also felt about, we all felt about Justice League, but that was rewritten because of a particular
right.
event.
I mean, that was
but
very clearly was, that.
Yeah, that was very clear. Like one
and
end.
And before
of it,
anybody says like I have a hate on for DC, I loved Wonder Woman.
No, this was better.
Yeah,
look,
like,
this was much better than Justice League, but not as good as Wonder Woman though. Anybody no. who says that Aquaman is better than Wonder
I mean,
Woman,
I would
is
say
just
yeah.
out
I
of
mean,
their
Aquaman
minds.
Versus Suicide Squad. I'm taking Aquaman. I got to be honest.
I guess that's true.
Yeah,
you know,
I would too. But I what I was going to say was, and I was trying to remember the comic that this reminded me of. You are absolutely right in terms of Mira and Arthur and how in the beginning he's dumb, but she's smart. It's like Sheena. I felt like Sheena'd her. Like Sheena, Queen of the Jungle, been living in the jungle, can command all these animals and everything. And all of a sudden, Bob Reynolds shows up and she's like, help. I don't know what I'm doing. And it did have a little of that.
You know who my favorite actor was in this movie?
Who?
Dolph Lundgren.
Ha!
I thought he did great.
I wasn't ready. It took me 10 minutes of seeing him with the red hair to figure it yeah. out.
And let me say this. Like, I love, first of all, I love Jason Momoa as Khal Drogo. I love what I've seen of him as a person. He seems like a genuinely good guy for the most part, based on his public persona, as much as I can say that. I love his enthusiasm for a lot of stuff. Like, he's a great ambassador for this material. But man, I wanted to like him in this movie. I wanted to, and people are going to love the way he looks. I at the screening that Danny and I were at, a woman, there's a scene where he shows up at the beginning and he's shirtless and he turns around and this woman behind me goes, "Oh my Jesus Lord," like that. So there is going
it's
to
in
be,
the trailer.
Yeah,
you guys
he's,
have seen that
he's
scene,
going to
more.
Be, there is going to be a lot of thirst trapness around him in this movie, and justifiably so. He looks great.
He looks great. I don't think Amber looks as good.
He feels so uncomfortable. They do this thing, and this is like my theater nerd side coming out, where you think that being more natural means being a little more shuffly and a little more moving around instead of just planting your feet and saying your line. But because that's what we do as people when we're talking. We shuffle around, we move and all that stuff. But on screen, on stage, it doesn't look good. It looks like you are uncomfortable. It looks like you don't know what you're doing. And both him and Amber Heard do that throughout this movie. It's like, Jason, just plant your feet. Speak your line. That's it. You don't need to shuffle around and move your body and, you know, all this stuff. It's just deliver your lines and you'll be good. And he doesn't. And it just, oh God, it drove me nuts throughout the course of the movie. And I wanted to like him. I like Momoa as a whole, but
I do think that Aquaman fans are gonna, I still think they will like it. They will like, this is, they combined a couple universes, I think, in this movie. You can see, yes, it is his origin story, but there are a couple things that I'm like, okay, if they do another Justice League or whatever, I'm not quite sure how they're going to.
There's bring a lot this back of New around. 52 stuff of it. The,
yeah, it's
the,
very
the
New
desert
52.
Stuff, the stuff, those fish monsters from the trench.
Yes,
that's another thing.
I will say that this is the thing I want to say. There was one segment of this movie I liked, which was that there's a moment where they go to the trench. They have to go to the trench, and there are these under siege dwellers there that have devolved into these monsters. And I thought that was beautifully shot.
It was
really artistically done in terms of there's this chase scene. And
yes, you mean the thing that looked most like a horror movie was the thing that the horror movie director did good.
It looked like it was
a very Cthulhu.
Yeah,
it had a vibe.
It was. I mean, and even the sound design in that section. That's why I feel like, and there were moments like that. I can name maybe three more, but they're not connected congruously. They're not seamless. So that's why I feel like so much of this got lost on the cutting room floor or got script changed into,
the incongruity is the thing that comes back to me over and over again. And honestly, I have to tell you, I actually like Black Manta. There's a whole.
No, I liked him. I just thought it was a bad usage of him. Yeah. I thought there could have been more of him.
But I mean, yeah, there's a whole bit where he gets the parts of the suit,
mm-hmm.
and then
he's
Tony Starking his version of the suit, and it's kind of goofy and it's kind of fun. And as pertains to the post-credit sequence, there's a bit that involves him as well. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, man, why was this not the dude?
Right.
Exactly.
I thought he was.
That's what I'm saying. It's
much
not like
more interesting character.
I don't want anybody to think that I did not like Black Manta. I thought, just like Adam said, it was a bad use of him.
That should clarify that too. I had no problem with the actor. I thought he did a great job.
I like that one
he
scene though.
Cool.
Him making the suit was a fun scene.
His relationship to his dad. Else.
And then he disappears for the entire third act of the movie. Like that's what makes me think it's just like,
right, for Ocean Master.
Yeah. So yeah. Like,
and
I
love Patrick Wilson. What a bummer. Great actor. That was not it.
Yeah, and not only the only other thing, is it just me or do they always seem to shoot him from the same side? Like that was just one thing that just caught me off guard. I'm like, I'm not seeing the other side of this man's face.
Yeah. I have no problem with Black Manta as a character. It's just the way he was handled in the movie I thought was poor.
But hey, I'll tell you what, if you watch the movie and you thought it was fun, you had a good time, here's a great opportunity for you to go to a comic book store and pick up the new issue of Aquaman, written by Kelly Sue DeConnick, which is its own story.
Can I just tell you, it's sold out in the two stores I went to. Like, I got a...
Aquaman number 43.
Yeah.
Came out this week. Kelly Sue DeConnick. So if you're so excited about Captain Marvel, keep in mind that the Captain Marvel you're getting is basically Kelly Sue's Captain Marvel, and she's taking on Aquaman now, and it is a real bare bones. Arthur doesn't know who he is. He's on an island. Stuff's going
amnesia.
On. Yeah. So if you didn't know anything, if this was your first Aquaman comic, and the only thing you know about Aquaman is this movie, you're good.
You can jump in. It's a good jumping off point.
So yeah, jump to a comic book store or go to Comixology or wherever you get your digital comics, and totally worth a look in my opinion. So there you go. I always like to throw in a little bit of comic love where it's available. What do you think won the
Bumblebee
week?
Bumblebee won my week.
Karima?
Yeah, I'm going to have to say Bumblebee won my week too.
You know, I actually think for me it was Mary Poppins. Mary Poppins Returns, for whatever reason, I felt the great connection to. But we can give it to Bumblebee since it's two out of three.
I mean, we can each have our own.
No, we can have, you're outvoted. The holidays, you're outvoted as usual, but it's fine.
Wow. Okay.
But I think in terms, I mean, Aquaman's going to win the box office by leaps and bounds, I would say.
I agree that that's probably
true. I think it's going to win the box office for a few weeks, but I believe Mary Poppins might be a sleeper. Oh. And that in terms of like, I don't want to say aftermarket, DVD.
We'll see. Look,
and
great.
On demand. I think it could make a lot of money on that because kids need to watch something. Go watch Mary Poppins
again. It's interesting to see
dinner.
How musicals perform because keep in mind, The Greatest Showman was not number one,
that's
but
true.
It stayed like number five or six for a month. So we'll see. All right. That's a good point. Well, thank you for listening to this podcast. If you have not subscribed, please subscribe. If you've never given a review, give a review. It definitely helps us. And check out all the other podcasts, The Phantom Files, Strong Female Characters, Battlestar Galactic Cast, and check out all of the Amazon podcasts that we have with your Alexa skill. Before we wrap up, where can the kids find you at home?
They can find me, Karima, the Blurred Girl, TheBlerdGurl, all over the interwebs, but mostly Twitter and Instagram.
And you can find me at Rock the Faces on Instagram. Be sure to at me with your hot Aquaman takes.
My name is Danny Roth, and you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Danny Ordinary. That is Danny with one N, Ordinary also with one N. This has been Who Won the Week. Thank you for winning our week, and we'll see you again next week.